I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
Good morning, I'm Allison Fox. I'm one of the co-producers of the Prison Voices Project, and I'm an assistant professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz. I'm really excited about today's show because I think it features some content that really relates to the impact of incarceration, not only on girls and young women, but also to individuals incarcerated in New York State who are seeking opportunities not only to educate themselves on the inside, but also beyond bars. Today, I'm featuring content from the New York City-based radio station WBAI, a great show called On the Count. The show itself was founded in 2002 by the late, great Eddie Ellis. Eddie Ellis is someone who really transformed our national conversation about criminal justice. He is someone who himself was incarcerated for a number of years and came out and really led a movement of individuals who had been incarcerated who really have played a deep role in transforming our current approaches to incarceration. And Eddie has mentored and taught and really framed so many ideas and perspectives around criminal justice reform, including my own. Eddie is someone who taught me so much about how we use language and how we think about people who are inside prison. The show continues on. It's a show produced and written and put out entirely by formerly incarcerated people. And the show that I'm showing today is a show that came out in August of this year, and it features an interview with Vivian Nixon, who really has led the state and really a national movement to not only transform prison education behind bars, but also our conversation about the stigma of a criminal conviction in the application process for individuals coming out of prison and seeking to continue higher education behind bars. This show aired on WBAI in the middle of August, and thanks to Stephen Mangual, the producer of the show, and Khalil Cumberbatch and others at WBAI's On the Count for letting us rebroadcast this content. Really grateful to them for letting us do that. The second offering I have today are two beautiful songs produced by the beautiful young women over at Columbia Secure Center in collaboration with Found Sound Nation, which is an organization that does a lot of great work producing music projects both inside juvenile facilities but also in a number of other different contexts. And this was a project run by Jeremy Thal at Found Sound Nation at Columbia Girls Secure Center, which is, for those of you who live in the area, just right outside of Hudson. And the two songs that I'm going to share today, Rain Boots and Start Over, were produced by the young women in the facility. I've had the opportunity to spend time with a lot of these young women, and they are the most magical group of people that I've had the opportunity to meet in the last year. They're brilliant, wonderful people, and I think two seldom do we get a chance to hear about the stories of girls behind bars. Columbia Girls Secure Facility is for girls charged as adults facing adult-level sentences. I'm going to start out with the first song produced by Jeremy Thal and the folks at Found Sound Nation and written and performed by the girls at Columbia Girls Facility. And I thank the Office of Children and Family Services for allowing us to share this song on the radio. The song is called Start Over.
Thank you. was steady blessing you. When you was knocking, I was free. I was steady checking you, answering your calls and writing letters. But a dog gon' do a dog do. I really knew better. If love is blind, lust had me paralyzed. We used to be like forever this, forever that. Now we ain't never getting back to bossing together. No big suits or flossing together. I did you wrong, you did me wrong, but ain't no talking together. We can never work it out, and part of that changed me. I'm feeling like fat, baby, this is what you made me. Can't lie, you cross my mind every now and then. But you deserve an Oscar, how you play pretend. Keep it real, I'm the one who made you bend.
Starting all over from nothing, trying to get something. All of my life, I've been wanting to get up on my own 2 feet. Never being a statistic, running the streets. Try to get a job, seemed like no one would hire me. They said the petitions failed and that they were sorry. But there's nobody more sorry than I. Cause I'm the one who's barely getting by. Thinking what I could do to get up out of this. The more I thought about it, the more I got pissed. Oh God, why hast thou forsaken me? Feeling like any moment now I go crazy. Had to get a grip and pull myself together. My mom saw a tougher time than this, I remember. My mom's trying to get us closer, boots in the winter. How can she do this with welfare? We'll only send her a measly few dollars for all 3 kids. How in the hell did they expect us to live? My mom's with the struggle and she went through so much pain. That's where I got the courage. I had to start all over again.
Over again, over again.
Over from the bottom, trying to make it up. Wasn't nothing, give it to me, man, I had to play it tough. Now I'm locked up, but I still got love. Family and support, man, so who's the judge? I got God on my side, so it's nothing but love. And everywhere I go, man, it's never no trust. But everywhere I go, I'ma keep it a bug. So I just keep it pushing till they call me a bluff. And you ain't never catching me lacking, cause enough is enough. I'm starting all over, best believe me and trust.
I got depressed when you left, cause I messed up. Now you with another hitter, man, he lucked up. And it's crazy, cause you know I need you back. You know I miss you back, and you could call it what you want. It's nothing less than the facts. I'm just expressing how I feel. You acting like you tough, like your heart made of steel.
We started knowing.
That was Start Over by the young women at Columbia Secure Facility, located in Claverack, New York. That track was produced by the Found Sound Nation and written and sung by the women at Columbia Girls Secure Facility. Next, we're going to hear the show On the Count, produced by Stephen Mangual and the production team at WBAI's On the Count.
On the count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
All my people up the rave, bro.
Where you at?
All my people up the bar flip.
Where you at?
All my people everywhere, inside of prison and out, where you at? I know where we are at. We are in the luxurious studios of WBAI Free Speech Radio, part of Pacifica, 99.5 FM, here in what Eddie used to call the borough of Gunsmoke, Brooklyn, New York. I am Stephen Humble Mangual. I will be your host today, and we have an awesome, awesome program set for you today. I'll be with you for the next 55-ish minutes, and we have an awesome guest who is going to be sharing with us her experience, her expertise, and some of the work that she has done, is doing, is planning on doing moving forward with respect to higher education and mass incarceration. So without any further ado, we have Miss Vivian Nixon. I'm sorry, Reverend Vivian Nixon on the line with us. She is the executive director of the College and Community Fellowship, an innovative organization that assists formerly incarcerated women in pursuit of higher education, leadership skills, and career paths that lead to economic security. Reverend Nixon came to CFF in 2001 as a student following a period of incarceration, during which, as a peer educator to other incarcerated women, she became painfully aware that lack of education severely impedes the ability to escape the cycle of poverty and recidivism. So, without any further ado, I'd like to welcome, no stranger to On the Count, Miss Vivian Nixon.
Hi, Steve. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. I'm blessed. And definitely happy to have you here on the count with us again. I know it's been a little while. I think the last time may have been last year during the Women's History March.
Yes.
A march during Women's History Month, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that was the last time I was on.
So how are you?
I'm well. I'm well, and I'm so happy to have this opportunity to speak to the On the Count audience, an audience that really cares about this issue and has been loyal for so many years. And every time I come on the show, I can't help but, you know, remember Eddie and how good a friend he was and how he really created a space for us to have these conversations on the air. So in honor of Eddie, I'm happy to be here.
I'm so glad that you are. So we want to cover certain specific things, but then I also want to cover general things if we have time regarding mass incarceration. But why don't we start with, because I know we have people listening, and of course our main constituency is still the men and women who are currently incarcerated, who are able to pick up the frequency. And so my focus, which is has always been our focus on this radio show On the Count, has been first and foremost the men and women who we left behind and who we're really connected to. So just so for the sake of those who may not have heard your name, and even their family members who are listening, and maybe someone who's tuning in for the first time, just for them, why don't you tell us a little bit background? So tell us a little bit about yourself so we can get to know who Vivian Nixon is and some of your influences that led you to, you know, joining this struggle and being a leader in this struggle. So let's start with a little historical perspective.
Sure. And I'm happy to talk to those who are currently incarcerated and their family members, because I have lived that experience. And when you are alienated from the rest of society, you are thirsty for information. So when I was incarcerated, which was from 1997 through 2001, one of the things that became most obvious to me was that there was this really obvious connection between education and incarceration. Many of the women that I met and encountered, of all ages, ranging from 17 to 70, had very low literacy rates, had not graduated high school, and had kind of moved into this space in their lives where, in order to survive, they got involved in activities that had been criminalized. And that's largely due to the increasing need for education in today's economy in order to get a job that matches the cost of living. And so I became fascinated with this idea. I already had a high school diploma. I was devastated because college courses were no longer available in the prisons by the time I was incarcerated, they were available in some prisons but not others. Where I ended up, it was not available. So, you know, after I got myself together, because the first, you know, 6 to 9 months I was just really reeling from, you know, being incarcerated. It's a shock to your system, right?
I call that the grieving process. I call that the grieving
process. Right.
Yeah.
Where you just don't do anything for like 6 to 9 months. You're just like, oh my God,
yeah.
I'm locked up, and these people who don't necessarily have my best interests at heart control every movement I make, and at any time they can arbitrarily punish me or throw me in solitary. It was just a shock to my system. So when I got over that, I said, you know, I really need to do something to benefit the other women around me. There were some things that I knew, some experiences that I had, some education that I had that I could share with others. So I began to tutor other women. Formerly, as my job as a peer educator in the adult basic education process, but also on my unit in my dorm, you know, writing letters to lawyers for people, helping people understand letters that were written to them. So that's how I became really passionate about the idea of education. When I was getting released, I found out about this organization, College and Community Fellowship, otherwise known as CCF, and when I got out, I joined the organization. They helped me get my degree, and ultimately I came to work for the organization, and now I'm the executive director. The organization initially was put in place simply to mentor and tutor other formerly incarcerated women as they move through the stages of higher education and make sure they earn their degrees. But we evolved. We evolved into the area of public policy and joined with other organizations to create the Education from the Inside Out Coalition to combat the systemic policies that prevent people who are in prison and people with criminal histories from going to college. In my view, these barriers, taking college out of prisons and restricting people from access to college even after incarceration, are vestiges of our system of racial oppression, where at one point it was illegal for African Americans to learn how to read and write.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's how I became really passionate and involved in this issue. So when I joined the organization as a student, I knew that this organization understood the systemic barriers that people face, and they also understood structural racism. But the approach of the organization was very much individualized, helping formerly incarcerated women get college degrees, a very worthy goal all by itself. But I truly believed that in order to make a bigger impact on our society, we needed to find a way to influence systemic change. And that's when we began to have conversations with first at the city level, then at the state level. I remember one of the first testimonies I did was to the New York State Sentencing Commission, where I talked about education needing to be an integral part of the reentry process. Because at the time, everyone was talking about reentry, and they would kind of name these three core components of reentry: housing, jobs, and substance abuse treatment, which are all extremely important. But I was like, there's something missing. And, you know, a four-legged stool is more sturdy than a three-legged stool.
That's
and
right.
For me, the fourth leg of that stool was education. So I began to travel around to conferences and meetings and kind of promote the idea of education. And ultimately, within the last 2 years, started to get the ear of the federal government, both the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, and we've made some great strides. And I really want to talk about the recent announcement that the Department of Education made regarding experimental sites initiatives that would allow people in prison to get Pell Grants, despite the fact that in 1994 those grants were banned.
We know education works, right? You've been doing this for 20 years, specifically since you know, probably since before you even were released, where even in your experience, you couldn't, you know, you didn't have tap and pill while you were incarcerated to take advantage of that. And so you already knew from then that, listen, this is something that works. We've known that we've got study after study. We have live, I mean, people who are here who, I mean, nationwide, 43.3% of formerly incarcerated individuals, right, are likely to return to prison within 3 years of release. The likelihood drops to 5.6% for a bachelor's degree recipient and then less than 1% for a master's degree. So we've known this, right? So why a pilot program? Why not just make this happen?
Well, because making it happen requires an act of Congress, and I think we all know that Congress is at a stalemate right now. They don't do much of anything, and certainly nothing that the Obama administration supports. And so what we've seen over the past year or so is the administration looking at what they can do by executive order. So this pilot program is not really meant to study post-secondary education in prison as a way to prove that it works, because we already know it works. But it's meant to open up the doors of access for as many people as possible while we continue the fight for total reinstatement. Look, we were offered, more than 6 years ago, we were offered from the Department of Education to do something exactly like this. And we said, no, we'd rather try to work through the legislative process to get the ban reversed altogether. But we weren't successful at that. So sometimes you have to take baby steps and be a little incremental. I often ask people who are staunch abolitionists who are like, oh, we should just shut down all the prisons. I'm like, and then what? Right? Like, there really needs to be some strategic plan, and it may require a tolerance for incrementalism to get where we need to go.
But this definitely seems to be a bipartisan issue. I mean, right now, I know, and you even mentioned that we know what's happening. You know, anything that, President Obama, his administration pushes forward, we're going to have, you know, those that are going to go against it just because it's him that's proposing it. But it, this is definitely a bipartisan, you know, issue, and really across the board. I mean, just to quote the U.S. Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, he says that, as the president recently noted, for the money that we currently spend on prison, we could provide universal pre-K for every 3- and 4-year-old in America, or double the salary of every high school teacher in the country. I mean, Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever your political, you know, where you are found on that spectrum. I mean, this seems to be, you know, an issue where it affects everyone, and everyone could benefit, right?
Everyone could benefit, and there's great economic arguments for doing it, but there's also, for me and from my point of view, there's huge moral arguments. Look, the people in our prison systems are disproportionately poor, disproportionately undereducated, disproportionately black and brown. And this, the legacy of structural racism in this country is closely tied to education, which is the pathway to achieving the American dream that so many people are so proud of, you know, that in America, if you work hard and you do the right thing, you can rise up. And, you know, that is somewhat of a myth, because there are millions of people who work hard every day, who do the right thing, and will never reach the pinnacle of the American dream, because we've made it more difficult for them to access the education that they need to move up that socioeconomic ladder. One of the things that, and while there is some bipartisan support around these general criminal justice issues, even the things that the president is trying to do by executive order are being discounted by certain other political figures who say that he has no right to do things by executive order. Well, of course he does. He's the president. He's the executive. The law allows him to do certain things. There are so many underlying reasons why Congress is fighting against everything the president does, and I don't want to move too far off the track, but It's unprecedented. It is really unprecedented the way this president has been demonized, and Congress has not cooperated with this president.
Yeah.
But he's not doing anything that any other president hasn't done. Executive order has existed through our entire history, and every president, including Republican presidents, have used that power.
So in light of this reinstatement, right, what do you think Governor Cuomo should be doing regarding TAP reinstatement, at least here in New York State? And have there been some inroads with his administration here in New York?
So Governor Cuomo, at the Black Caucus, I believe in 2014, went to an African-American church on a Sunday and announced that, you know, he was going to start this program in New York State to provide resources to college programs in prison. But he didn't do his homework. And so immediately there was backlash from the other side. And because the governor's administration wasn't prepared for that backlash, they shut the idea down. We were very disappointed in that because we felt if he had consulted with grassroots constituents, we would have given him some firepower to fight back at all of these claims that this would cost too much money or that people didn't deserve education. I'm hoping that the federal government's courage on this issue transfers over to the state of New York, and that the administration in New York finds its courage again and comes up with a plan to either do its own sort of separate funding of college programs in prison or reinstate TAP grants. The reinstatement of TAP grants, of course, would require legislation, but the governor could also do some things with the budget outside of the TAP grants.
So let's talk a little bit about, because one of the questions would be, like specifically for the Pell Pilot Program, where's this money coming from? I mean, is this taxpayer money? Is this, you know, because this, I remember, because I was also incarcerated during that time, and I went upstate in 1994, May 1994, September 1994, I enrolled in the college program, got one semester in. My second semester, which was the summer of 1995, was the last semester.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I was there also. I was actually at Eastern Correctional Facility at this time. And, yeah, I was really upset, and I was reading and listening to what was happening during this time frame where they were saying, oh, why are we paying all of this money for, you know, these criminals, these convicts? Why are they going to prison when my child is – I mean, I'm sorry. Why are they going to college when my child can't go to college? And, you know, so talk a little bit about, you know, that aspect, the money aspect. I mean, how much goes into and what, you know, where does it come from, the money?
So the first thing I tell people is that the great thing about Pell Grants is that if you are financially eligible, you get one. Like, it doesn't matter if you're in prison or out of prison. If you are eligible based on the citizenship criteria, the financial criteria, and the fact that you are enrolled in school, you get a Pell Grant. No child of any citizen who's not incarcerated has ever been denied a Pell Grant because a Pell Grant went to someone incarcerated. That's not how the system works. It works on eligibility criteria. So people getting Pell Grants in prison are not taking money away from quote-unquote law-abiding citizens. That's the first thing. The second thing is that at the height of usage, which means when the most people in prison were receiving Pell Grants, the amount of money being spent on prison education was 0.1% of the Pell Grant budget. That's what the Secretary of Education called in the press conference regarding the experimental sites. He called that budget dust. It's just really an inconsequential amount of money.
Yeah.
The money for the Experimental Sites Initiative is actually money that the Department of Education already has in its budget to do these experimental sites. And experimental sites over the years have been done to study different things. One example is they used experimental sites to study the quality and effectiveness of online education, which was a relevant study. It was needed at the time because more and more institutions did this. And so it's not costing taxpayers any additional money whatsoever.
That was a segment from WBAI's On the Count. You're listening to WGXC, the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, one of your co-hosts. Next, we're going to listen to a song called Rain Boots, which was written and performed by the young women at Columbia Girls Secure Facility located in Claverack and produced during a music project that was done with the Found Sound Nation just this past July. The song is called Rain Boots.
Yeah. Check. 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 Check.
Girl, you look so cute over there in your bathing suit with rain boots. With rain boots. Girl, you look so good roaming around my neighborhood eating grapefruit. Eating grapefruit. Girl, you look so cool. Walking around last night at school with a parachute. With a parachute.
From the planet Mars, driving fancy cars.
Girls, just wanna have fun.
From the planet Mars, driving fancy cars.
Girls, just wanna have fun.
We win, we win, we always win that race. Second best, you could jack that, long as you know your place. Came through and I took that, couple stacks in my book bag. Never cared what you had, never checked the price tag. Couple cuties, my contacts. We here, where y'all at? I'm summer ready, gonna hit the town. I'm the best, hands down. Bow, when I come around, call me highness, I wear the crown. I just started and I'm never done, partying until the sun. Y'all mad, cause I won? Getting pretty and having fun.
Getting pretty and having fun.
So when we left off, you mentioned we mentioned Pell and what that was. For those who are hearing for the first time, because I'm sure even people who are incarcerated right now, currently incarcerated, who, you know, the college program hasn't been a reality for them. I mean, it was taken away 1994, but 1995 summer was the last class. I mean, we're talking 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now you have a whole generation of people who are incarcerated now who it wasn't even a reality for them. So if they're listening now and wondering, we told them about Pell, but now TAP. TAP is tuition assistance program, right? And it's a state. So let's educate some of them.
New York State grants that are given to students to supplement their tuition. And it was taken away right after the government took away Pell grants. Governor Pataki at the time took away TAP grants. Look, this is an easy fix, right? TAP grants have the same quality as Pell grants in terms of it's your eligibility is determined by your income, and it really should be determined by nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
But when the governor said he didn't want it to go to incarcerated students, it became law. We have there is a bill in the New York State Legislature right now to reverse that decision, but it's going to require a ton of constituent support. And you know, we know how the state legislature works right now. There's kind of a real divide between the left and the right. We've got to work really hard to get people on the right to understand how important this is. There are champions that we have, Assemblyman Jeffrey Aubrey, Senator Velmanette Montgomery, Senator Gustavo Rivera, just to name a few, and there are many more, who really believe in this and understand it, but they need the citizens of New York State to reach out to their local elected officials, their assembly person, their senator from their district, and say, this is what we want. We understand that people in prison are there for a reason, but the sentence is being incarcerated. The sentence, we should not add on additional punishments to the sentence. Mm-hmm. You were not sentenced to ignorance. Mm. So education should be part of your incarceration experience.
So now the bill you're talking about, is that the Restoring Education and Learning Real Act?
No, the Real Act is federal legislation.
Right. Okay.
And that would bring back Pell Grants nationally.
Okay.
It was introduced by Donna Edwards of Maryland. It has over 44 co-sponsors right now. Mm-hmm. And we are hoping that there's a companion bill introduced in the Senate in the fall.
Okay. So we definitely need our people to support these bills. I just
absolutely.
So.
There's another bill in the state of New York called the Fair Access to Education Act. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the bill numbers in front of me, but it's easy to look up. That would prevent colleges in New York State from asking people about felony convictions before making a decision about admission.
Right
now, the State University of New York is one of the biggest culprits. So they ask about felony convictions on the application. And then each campus, and there are over 60 campuses of the State University of New York, each campus deals with that question in a different way, which is unfair to applicants to the State University of New York. There are a couple campuses that actually turn those applications over to the campus security guards and let them make a decision. Now, some of these security guards don't even have college educations, but they're making a decision about who's qualified to go to college.
Wow. Yeah, that definitely says a lot about, you know, who is it that's given this control. And really, we know they should not have that control. They're not qualified.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about, because I know we mentioned Education from the Inside Out Coalition, but for those who are possibly listening for the first time, how did that come about, and who is that coalition?
So that coalition is composed of individuals and organizations from around the country who care about access to education for people currently incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, and those with felony convictions. Mm-hmm. So every systemic barrier or structural barrier that's put up against people who fit those criteria from getting education are things we fight against. Mm-hmm. The core members of that coalition are the College and Community Fellowship, Just Leadership USA, and the Center for Community Alternatives. But we have many, many other partners, including the Prisoner Reentry Institute at John Jay, many of the existing privately funded college programs, the Fortune Society, and others. And what we've done is the legislation that I just mentioned, including the REAL Act, which is federal legislation around Pell, mm-hmm. the Fair Access to Education Act in New York State, and the Build to Reinstate TAP in New York State, were instituted by the Education from the Inside Out Coalition. And what we've been doing is building a constituency to push for that legislation to become law.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like such an easy solution, right? And we know it, looking at it from, you know, people who were incarcerated and formerly incarcerated and knowing how it works. I mean, I have a friend of mine who, you know, he's listening now, one of my Conciencia mentors, and he says, you know, this country has the economic means to reinstitute college in every prison. You know, it's just, it doesn't seem like very difficult decision or solution, but, you know, you did mention what's happening, you know, in the halls of government today and how there's so much opposition.
Yeah, it's really strange that the moral imperative is not resonating with folks who claim to be the moral core of the country, right? Mm. These are largely conservative, very religious people who somehow don't really connect the primary principle of their religion, which is that people can change, that forgiveness is part of the equation, mm-hmm. that you should help your fellow man. Mm-hmm. All of the things that are the mm-hmm. core aspects of religion don't seem to come into play in their politics, mm-hmm. which is really hilarious to me.
Especially not when it comes to, you know, people who have been labeled convicts and felons and, you know, other such dehumanizing, you know, labels that we, especially here, those of us who come under the tutelage of RLS and the non-traditional approach, know that, you know, we have to change that language and those labels because they are dehumanizing. And some of them become self-fulfilling prophecies as well.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts regarding that and those labels and the importance of language?
So I think language is extremely important, especially when the labels have a negative connotation or the labels identify people as less than other people. And I think we need to be very, very careful about the use of language. Of course, Eddie Ellis was a pioneer in this, in that he suggested that whenever we talk about people, we use the word people. People in prison, people with felony convictions, people with criminal history records, but basically just people.
Mm-hmm.
We don't identify any other population by an act that they did or their history like we do with people who have been involved with the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to call up an employer and say, look, I have a great candidate for this job. The candidate has this experience, has this capacity, is really willing to work as a hard worker. And then, you know, later on the employer may find out about the criminal history record.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to call up an employer and say, I have an ex-con I want you to hire.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It immediately has a negative connotation.
Yeah, sure it does. It definitely does. You know what I like to do in my work is I usually wait. Like, I wait a while, and, you know, eventually I just share some of my experiences, some of my expertise in the field, and then later on, after I'm working side by side with someone, I wind up getting into the conversation and, you know, because of course I want to protect myself too, and I want to just feel them out and see do they hold, you know, prejudices or preconceived notions of people who are incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, because I definitely want to show them. I say, well, you know what, here you are, you've been working with me, and I am one of the formerly incarcerated, and I just like to see the look on their faces.
I do that sometimes too, because people are like, what, are you kidding?
Yeah.
You know, we find that with our students a lot too, and one of the reasons that support programs like college and community fellowship are needed to help women navigate the college experience is that oftentimes when you're in classes, sociology classes, political science classes, et cetera, issues of incarceration and crime come up as a topic of conversation in the classroom.
Yeah.
And not all of the comments are positive.
Mm.
So if you're sitting in the classroom and you know you have this experience and people are saying awful things about this population, you need a way to navigate that. You need some support with that.
Yeah.
And so that's why college programs like ours are really helpful.
Talk a little bit about how college transforms the individual. Like, what are some of the dynamics, in your opinion, that take place there? You know, that have taken place in your life that we see in the lives of other people who, you know, it's like this light bulb goes off and it's like, I mean, you know, I mean, I know I obviously experienced it as well, but I just want you to just share a little bit about your experience and how that plays out.
So for me, it's like you go through life, especially when you are part of any marginalized group and you're told, even if you're not told directly, it is implied that there are certain things that you are not going to have access to, that you can't accomplish certain things. And so so many of us start out in life setting the bar really low based on where we grew up, based on our ethnicity, based on the amount of money our family has, and what we believe we can access in this society. When you begin to get educated, you realize that America really is a great country, and there really is a tremendous amount of opportunity out there what is needed is for people to be more informed about those opportunities and to be educated to take advantage of those opportunities. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not saying that racism still won't impact you. Oh, my God, it mm-hmm. will.
Yeah.
But when you have the educational tools to navigate all the systems and structures,
mm-hmm.
you can experience that racism, but also combat it with intelligence and real information, rather than just the emotion of feeling like you've been discriminated against. And, you know, that can go two ways. You become really angry and bitter, mm-hmm. or you become self-defeating.
Mm.
Education allows you to overcome that.
And now what about for the individual and their maybe developing certain ethical, moral, boundaries and stuff that they may not have had? Because many of us, and this also plays to what you mentioned about the historical, you know, background in our culture and upbringing and how it plays, you know, a role in some of the poor decisions that we made. And then later when we start getting educated, now all of a sudden we start developing a whole different outlook just on ourselves. We start taking, you know, talk about the individual responsibility transformation, the developing of morals and ethical values now that play a role that are directly connected and linked to, you know, higher education.
Well, so morality is a very complicated thing because
sure
it, it changes from society to society.
Mm-hmm.
But we're here in America, and we have a certain set of moral standards. But underlying even moral standards is the basic human survival instinct.
Mm.
Excuse me. So I believe that in a society where you grow up believing that you are not a full member of society, and
mm-hmm.
that you are subject to be preyed upon by police, by prosecutors, by the system in general, it's fight or flight, right?
Also, we can't deny the historical perspective and fact that where a group of people were denied even education, were denied the right to even read.
Exactly.
So we can't forget that.
So with that history, you have this fight or flight mentality, but when you begin to learn that you can overcome that and also learn that, hey, it's not just us. It's not just African Americans in the United States. Globally, there are people who are disenfranchised and marginalized and discriminated against, right? There's genocide going on. So much about our society becomes opened up with education. You begin to see yourself as part of a bigger picture, not only the bigger problems, but the bigger solutions.
Mm.
And that translates for me into a moral demand to be part of the solution. Most of the people who I know who get educated in prison or post-prison,
mm-hmm.
when you ask them what they want to do, they don't say, oh, I want to start the next tech company and make $1 billion. What they say is, I want to change this society. I want to make it more just for the people we left behind and the people in the neighborhood that I grew up in.
Mm.
So that's where the moral compass comes in, is that you feel a camaraderie with your fellow citizens
mm-hmm.
from not just your neighborhood but all over the world, and you're less likely to want to commit crimes against people
mm-hmm.
who you now have empathy for.
Yeah, that's right. I learned from studying the work of Paulo Freire when Pedagogy of the Oppressed and Liberation, Education for Liberation, where it starts with the transforming of the self, but now the transforming of the self is meant to now transform our society.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We're always in that process of becoming more fully human. So
yep.
Now, let's talk about CCF's annual block party.
Great. So we are so excited. This is our first annual block party.
Wow.
And the reason we are doing this is because we want the word to get out in New York City
mm-hmm.
that these services, educational services, are available to people who have criminal convictions. We want them and their families to take advantage of all the opportunities that are available. So on Monday
mm-hmm.
from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the Adam Clayton Powell Plaza, which is around the state office building on 125th Street and Adam Clayton Powell, we are going to be having a block party with a lot of special guests. More than 20 nonprofits are going to be there with information about the work they do to help people who have been incarcerated give them resources and information. We're going to have raffles and games and music and a dance contest. Glenn Martin, president of Just Leadership USA, is going to be our MC for the day. We're going to have a short theater performance from College and Community Fellowships Theater for Social Change. The Snow Day Food Truck, which is from Change Drive Change, will be there to give out free grilled cheese sandwiches. We're going to have free backpacks to give away, and the backpacks will be stuffed with school supplies. This is a back-to-school block party.
Wow.
So it's meant to get the community excited about education, going back to school in the fall, and for those who have not thought about education to begin to think about it. We are working really hard to spread the word about this, and we're hoping that everyone comes out. It won't cost you a dime, and you will learn a whole lot if you come out on Monday.
Yeah, that's going to be, you said 20 different organizations that are going to be out there tabling and sharing information?
Yeah, 20 different organizations ranging from Just Leadership USA, Women's Prison Association, College Initiative, the Education from the Inside Out Coalition, and many, many more. And there'll be somebody there from your neighborhood so you can learn where you can go to get help with educational aspirations. Because not everybody knows how to navigate the higher education system. And we want people to know that there are folks out there who can help do that.
That's awesome. So this is the College and Community Fellowship annual, first annual block party.
Back to school block party.
Back to school block party. And this is taking place Monday.
Monday from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the plaza at Adam Clayton Powell and 125th Street.
Yes, yes indeed. So for all of you who are listening, you need to get there, jump on a train, jump on a bus. If you live in a neighborhood, just take a quick walk and get over there to 125th Street and support this wonderful work and be part of this historical annual Black Party. And you also have, isn't there also your gala coming up as well?
Yes, on October 22nd, we will be celebrating 15 years of doing this work.
Wow.
And that's a huge milestone for us. We're honoring the Ford Foundation and the founder of College and Community Fellowship, Ms. Barbara Martinsons. Tickets are available. If you go to our website, you can purchase early tickets. We're looking to have a fabulous party. It's going to be at 360, which is right next to the Tribeca rooftop. It's going to be a fabulous event. Breon Bain is going to perform, and we're trying to secure some other special guests. But most of all is to support the work of College and Community Fellowship and to honor people like Barbara Martinsons and the Ford Foundation that have provided us with the resources we needed to do this work for 15 years. So please, please, please support our annual gala on October 22nd.
And where would they go on to find more information about the gala?
You can go to www.collegeandcommunity.org.
Okay, awesome. And in that, on that same, on your same website, I'm sure they'll be able to see the post, the flyer for the annual Back to School Block Party as well, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so definitely. Get that website one more time.
www.collegeandcommunity.org.
So we are definitely close to wrapping up. And so what I'd like to do and what I usually like to do is a brief message from you to the brothers and to the sisters specifically who may be listening right now and their family members and what, you know, your parting words.
When I was incarcerated, like I said, that first 6 to 9 months, I was devastated. I thought my life is over. My parting words to all of you and your families, your life is not over. No matter what the length of your sentence is, freedom is more than an open door or an open gate. Freedom is freedom to learn, freedom to love, freedom to engage in relationships with other human beings. You still have that freedom. use that freedom to advance yourself, to educate yourself. Don't let your mind be incarcerated, even though your body is.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be.